I guess I grew up on an older road.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Hunting Collective. I'm Ben O'Brien, and I'm here with Phil, the engineer. Philip, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Phil.
Yeah, there's a thaw happening in Bozeman right now. It's very warm.
I know, dude. I just stepped outside because I spent a lot of my days on Zoom and then talking into a microphone. I step outside, and it is very nice.
I was walking around in a t-shirt. And just like a week ago, it was like 25 degrees below zero. What's happening?
Yeah, I'm not even wearing pants right now. Yeah. It's that warm. It's a heat wave. Hey, here's the thing. I just wanted to give like a quick story from the weekend. I took my son ice fishing. You know, my son is 4. And we went to the local pond. I guess it's the lake pond. Small body of water where we could catch a lot of panfish. We go there all the time. It's fun. We went there. And when we got there, I drilled 3 holes into the ice, Phil. Have you ever drilled a hole in the ice? Have you ever been ice fishing?
I have been ice fishing. I have not done the drilling myself.
Ah, well, I went to, yeah, you would. You're a very famous ice fisherman from the Meat Eater podcast.
My first fish was caught on tape. You can listen to me catching it. Yes.
Yeah, it'll be similar to the first turkey. We're going to catch that on tape too. Guarantee that. Guaranteed. It's a guarantee. But we went fishing. My plan was to drill one hole and fish from that hole because we didn't have long to fish. Well, I drilled the first hole. We start fishing. My son accidentally drops some of the maggots into the hole, and some of the filling for like the maggot container goes into the hole. So I'm like, I'm gonna cover that hole. I just kick some snow in that. I'm like, hey, let's go drill a couple holes over here. We had two. We went about, I'd say about 8 to 10 feet across the ice. Drilled 2 more holes. Put our poles in there. Dropped the line down to the bottom, cranked it up a few reels, and then reeled a couple of times and started doing our fishing. And it wasn't maybe 15 minutes of this. He gets so excited. He had just eaten a bunch of trail mix. And when he eats trail mix, he just eats the M&Ms. He doesn't even eat anything else. He just eats the M&Ms. So
yeah,
it's a bag of M&Ms.
I had to stop buying the trail mix that has any candy in it. I think even the raisins are sometimes too much for my kids. They just will only eat the raisins and like the banana chips or whatever.
Yeah. So yeah, when I buy him, he's like, can I get some trail mix? I'm like, no. Can you get a bag of M&Ms with some stuff to sort through to get to the M&Ms? But anyway, at least he has to work for it. Uh-huh. Anyway, he eats a bunch of M&Ms. He gets all excitable. He gets a little sugar rush. He starts grabbing all the rods, reeling them in, putting them back in the hole. It just becomes chaos. So I decided at this point, like, it's probably, let's just cash this one in. It's not gonna go well. His attitude's not shaping up to be great. Other times, he's spent hours out there with me staring at a hole, doesn't care. This time, I think it was just the right amount of sugar and attention span failures. And at this point, I decide I'm going to wrap it up. I turn around to pick up the chair to load it into the sled, and I look, and he falls directly into the first hole, full leg all the way up to the hip into that hole. And now I yank him out of there, like I've just caught the biggest fish of my life. Yank him out of there, and I run him immediately up to the truck, which isn't that far away. It's only 500 yards away up a little hill. I get him into the truck. I get his jacket off. I get his pants off. I get his underwear off. I get his wet sock, his wet boot off. It's all chaotic. He's crying. I'm trying to see if he's injured in any way. And then I put all I had. I didn't have like an extra pair of pants for him. All I had was like my knee-high First Light socks, which I put on him, and they went all the way up to his crotchal region. So he had pants socks, which he loved. And then he started to laugh hysterically at the fact that my socks immediately became pants to him. So I put the seat warmer on my truck. I turned the heat on. I wrapped him up in my jacket, and we were safe. But Phil, I just tell that as a cautionary tale. Don't buy trail mix if the kid's only going to eat the M&Ms. He was safe. He's fine. Don't be worried. But it's just like when you have a young child, these are the things that happen. You can't just go out in the outdoors without expecting something like this to happen.
Yeah, maybe I'm a bad dad. I when you have a kid, I feel like you hit like a reset button. On your entire life, and you have to be like, well, okay, we've got about like 5 or 6 years before we can actually start living normal lives again.
Yes.
And so yes. Even just like the thought of taking a 4-year-old ice fishing is just horrifying to me. It sounds like a bad time. But honestly, I think you're heroic for doing it. I think it's a good thing. I'm just either too lazy or too negligent to bring my children to have a fun outdoor experience.
Yeah, I mean, it is. And now, you know, when you have two kids, I have two kids. When you have you get to that age with an older child, then you have a younger one, then it's like cascading.
It exactly. Limits. That's
it's
right.
Like limiting and more limiting and more limiting. But I had talked to Ranella one time about this, where like you get your kids get to a certain age where it just opens up in this beautiful experience where they can now at least do things that you want to do at the level you want to do them. And you're not kind of ratcheting down the outdoor experience for your children. But I try to celebrate the process. So I think ice fishing, at least for my little guy, is a good way to keep him focused. And he's only ever caught one fish, but that fish was like, we won the Super Bowl. Actually, it was the day before the Super Bowl, I think he caught. I can't remember. But it was the celebration was just about like Tom Brady when he won that Super Bowl. And me, like when I won my gambling bets, when I bet on Tom Brady. It's all very similar celebrations. So he's learning, man. He's learning patience. He's learning risk and reward, apparently, when it comes to ice fishing. So I just want to put that out there at risk of being called a bad dad. You know, make sure you alert your children over and over and over where each hole is that you freshly drilled into the ice. Just make sure you do that. So moving on, we got a lot of sundry things to get to, Phil. We got a lot of updates to do. I got a lot of emails, and then we're going to get to the folks from Hunters of Color on Instagram, huntersofcolor.com, soon to be .org. Jimmy and Lydia are joining us from Oregon, and we're going to talk about their mission to bring more hunters of color into the fold. We'll talk about that before we get to it. But we got a lot of emails, as always. Thank you, everyone, for filling the THC inbox with pure joy. Josh, our frequent emailer, Josh, we're not telling anybody's last names anymore, Josh E., he said, "Dear sweet Benjamin and Philip, Ben, I went for breakfast the other morning at my favorite breakfast joint in Minnesota, and I swore I saw you. There's a man with your face, facial hair, and even wearing a hunting hat roaming around in Minnesota. I nearly pooped my pants until I thought, it's winter, and Ben lives in Montana. Here's hoping, post end of times, of course, I can run into you one day and genuinely shake your hand. Give Phil my best. Josh." I read this only to say this is like the fifth or sixth email I've gotten, and all of them are in Minnesota, and all of them are claiming to have seen me in Minnesota. So whoever the hell this is, prancing around Minnesota, doing Ben O'Brien stuff with my face.
Yeah, dressing like a turkey.
Yeah.
Wandering through the woods.
Wandering through the woods. Stop it. Stop it. Or keep doing it. I don't know. Whatever floats your boat, but If anybody knows a person in Minnesota specifically, and Josh, you can write back in and tell us like exactly where you were when you saw this person, we need to figure out who this is. And we need to stop them from just walking around with my face and doing stuff. Okay, Phil? You in on that? Just a quick check in there.
Yeah, I mean, it's I would say pretty much anywhere in America you could see like a white guy with a beard.
Don't do
and like a hunting
me.
Hat and be like, oh, that's Ben O'Brien. There he is. You know,
you could do that. You could do it. Yeah, it could be true. But there's some dude in Minnesota who specifically walks around in a place where some people that listen to this podcast hang out, because that is not the first time that I've received that alert. And no, I haven't been to Minnesota in some time. I'm trying to think. It's been a while. So this guy is an imposter. Don't let him, you know, don't let him fool you. Even if he is a nice guy, don't let him fool you. Next one. This is something that is really sad. Now, you will remember, I don't know, a couple weeks ago we were talking about that we might have Phil's first hunt for turkeys near Kalispell. It's possible. We've been looking into some things. And we've been even working with some of the local folks at the NWTF to find some places where we can hunt that they've also done some critical habitat work on. But we got an email last week from a guy saying there was a Bojangles Famous Chicken and Biscuits in Kalispell. So we could eat there just like Eric Hall does every morning before he goes turkey hunting. So it would be
every
kind of
morning.
A ceremony every morning. Ceremonial. We could have the ceremonial Eric Hall meal. But turns out not. Nay, it's a fraud. Joseph P. writes in, Emergent Hunter, longtime listener, first time emailer. It is with great sadness that I would like to inform you that the Bojangles restaurant in Kalispell is a diner and not the renowned Bojangles famous chicken and biscuits. I live in the Flathead for almost a decade, and I too was almost tricked by their name thievery. As a born and raised Southerner with an affinity for all things fried chicken and biscuits, especially Bojangles, I never set foot in this imposter on principle alone. It could be the best diner in the world, but I'll never know. He goes on, but that is the meat of it.
So I discovered this for myself. I didn't tell you about it. I was going to wait to bring it up. Because I was like, well, I've never even heard of Bojangles, like the chain.
Yeah, yeah.
So I looked it up just to see what kind of fare they serve. And then I went to go see where the one in Kalispell is. And I saw, yeah, no, they're just an independent standalone diner. But honestly, I mean, the decor inside looks fun. I'd be willing to give it a shot.
Well, Phil, I mean, it's up to you. It's your hunt. I'm not going to force anything upon you, but I feel like it would be blasphemous in the name of Eric Hall for us to go in there and eat whatever chicken they got in that place.
It's a really maybe, good point.
Maybe we can get Eric Hall to ship us some Bojangles for the hunt specifically. He's going to have to overnight it at his expense, but maybe he'll do
it. Yeah, by the time it comes here, we'll have some stale biscuits with some rubbery gravy and some rotten chicken.
Yeah, but that'll be perfect for our hunt. That's exactly what I'm looking for in terms of pre-hunt prep for your first ever foray into the woods. I don't know. I just wanted to update people on that. That's a big letdown for us, big letdown. But we are looking forward to Phil's first hunt. We got a lot planned for that. So stick around, as I know you will. Here's the next update. Got an email from James A.H. James A.H. He said, Ben and Phil and Ben, I am writing in regard to episode 165 and the gentleman looking for help starting getting into hunting. I'm no expert, but I certainly know a thing or two and would love to help. The Blue Ridge Mountains cover quite a stretch of territory in the state, and I'm not sure how close he actually is to me, but I'm willing to help. Ask me any questions you need. Now, why this is important is there's a logo underneath this writing, and the logo is that of the Virginia DWR, Department of Wildlife Resources. So at first when I saw that logo, I thought, oh no, the cops got us. They got us, because James is a conservation police officer in the state of Virginia. So we have not only do we have James offering help, and he is a qualified help at that, he's a conservation PO, but we have guys like Matt, John. I mean, I can list off we had about a dozen hunters in Virginia and North Carolina offer to take our new hunter, who we didn't name last week, who is an emergent, was a formerly, I guess, an anti-hunter, then became a non-hunter. Now he's trying to be a hunter. And we had at least a dozen people write in and offer to take him out. So we will keep you updated on that, but I just wanted to let everybody know we got that covered, and I thank you very much for helping with that. Now, probably the most prominent hunter to offer his help was that of Eric Hall. So Eric Hall sent us a little message, Phil, and play it for you right now.
Hey, Ben, Eric here. Yeah, the guy needs a mentor. I'm in the Blue Ridge Mountains. I'm not Virginia, but I'm close, one county away. I'm on the edge of Wilkes, right close to Allegheny County, which is one county away from Virginia, but this depends on where he's at in Virginia. In the Blue Ridge Mountains, I live right at the foot of them, so they're long. They're a pretty good mountain range. So if I can find out where he's at, I might be a candidate to help him, mentor him, be glad to do it.
So that's Eric Hall offering to take over the Blue Ridge with our new emergent hunter. So maybe we got some sort of chapter of the hunting collective, some sort of regional chapter of the hunting collective forming in the Blue Ridge Mountains. A regional chapter of the cult, Phil. You feeling that? Maybe we start regional chapters here. If we're going to have a cult, we might as well disperse and collect people, you know, where they live.
Yeah. So we'll just have, you know, we'll have like American Legion halls scattered across the country.
Full. Maybe the meeting place could be in Bojangles.
Yeah, there'll be unmarked abandoned buildings, but there'll be a graffiti of the White Claw logo. That's how you know that it's a chapter of the THC cult.
Yeah, perfect. So if anybody wants to start a regional chapter, it looks like we pretty much already have it in Virginia if we connect all these people. And of course, Eric Hall to lead them is perfect. So before we get to the next thing, we got a lot to say about this, you know, possible regional chapter of THC's cult. Jonathan F. wrote us in. He said, listening to the beginning of 165 and the gentleman who moved to my neck of the woods and felt compelled to reach out. I'm a fairly new hunter, so I share some sentiments, though I never once detested hunting, just bad hunters, which here in Virginia, we have quite a few, but not me. I'm young, understanding, and have access to both my own family's property as well as I know the area. Deer, turkey, upland game, small game, and amazing trout streams are all moments away from myself as well as this gentleman. My property is a place I take new hunters often and would love to add another to the group. It's a great, quiet place to learn without fear of other hunters interfering. And he gave his number. So there's a lot of examples of stuff like that. So thank you to everybody, Jonathan included, who reached out. And I think we might be onto something, Phil. We might have ourselves a regional chapter number one of the THC cult. All right, to move on to something very similar to that, we got an email from Andy T. He has something pretty cool I want to just tell you about. It's a little public service announcement. He said, I'm almost caught up on the podcast after binge-severing episodes while touring around North Carolina for work. Out here, we are chasing bushy tails and chomping at the bit for turkey season. That's true. He thanks us for what we do, and he also says, I have to give you guys a shout-out for addressing the adult onset hunter term and finding Eric's emergent hunter. A good friend and I started a side project we're calling Opportunity Outdoors to grow conservation through mentorship. We ended up having an awesome 2020 season taking emergent hunters out on different hunts and coaching them towards success. I heard the request for mentorship again on the show today, and I was reminded of my intent to write you guys for some time. So, if you want to learn more, anybody wants to learn more, North Carolina and Virginia, but anybody wants to learn more, look up at Opportunity Outdoors. And you can find more about that. And I'm glad that people like Andy T are out there doing it, because we need more people like them. And this is the year of the new hunter, Philip. So we got to embrace them, right?
Yeah.
You feeling warm and fuzzy over there?
I mean, as one of these new hunters, these emergent hunters, the former onset adult hunter, you know, I'm right there with everyone. We'll see.
Kindred spirit.
Yeah, exactly.
Kindred spirit.
I'm there.
Well, Andy said he has a North Carolina turkey camp, and he also has some people in Virginia who want to be mentors and need mentees. So if you're out there, go look them up, and you can be that. And maybe we have one guy who needs to hunt in Virginia, and that guy has probably more hunting opportunities than me and you in Montana. he's now full on ready to go. So yeah, if you're out there and you emailed in about this, I am going to connect you to this emergent hunter in Virginia in the Blue Ridge Mountains we heard about last episode. So stick and stay, and thank you for the THC cult and for coming through for this guy and for all of us. It means a lot, and we absolutely positively appreciate it. So Phil, I know we had talked about having Kayla Ray on this week, but she was a little bit busy. She had to do some stuff. She's on the road. She's in Texas. The weather's not great. Some things have happened. So we're going to have her on next week. But to titillate everyone who took part in the THC theme song contest, it's not really a contest. It's more like an art project that we're all taking part in. Phil, can I share with you another entry that I really liked?
I would love to hear it.
I promise I won't sing it. It more kind of feels like a rap song, if I'm being honest, which is okay. This is Kayla Ray is going to turn it into her own musical accompaniment. But she's going to be on next week. We set up a time with her. We got that locked in. So she's going to bring her guitar. And next week we'll have lyrics ready. But Phil, are you ready for Ryan S. and his little ditty about THC? You ready?
Let's hear it.
Okay. Here's some news from the outdoor life. The cult is back, so work sharp in your knife. Ben O'Brien talks hunting ethics with you. Phil the engineer might shoot a turkey, too. Our topics for the show will challenge your brain, so write to our inbox and make it rain. Talk about your hunts, hikes, and recent quarries, but remember Phil said no more shit stories. We aim for success and learn from our blunders, suited for both veteran and emergent hunters. Broadcasting from our studio in Montana, maybe from elk camp, or while rabbit hunting in Louisiana. You'll find Ask the Eagle and Eric Hall, so make a salty vegan. And crack a white claw, where facts are facts and opinions are subjective. You're listening to The Hunting Collective. Boom! in your face. Be my hype man, Phil. Do something to excite the people about this.
I'll play one of music. those air horn sounds.
Please, before and after that little ditty. Ryan S., he said, at the end, he said, cult member number 9894. I didn't know we were giving out numbers.
Oh, did I not tell you that I was doing that? I've been sending membership cards.
All to 9,894 people?
That's right.
All right, that's fine. Welcome. Cult number 9894, Ryan S. So next week, we're going to get into it, man. I'm excited. We got all kinds of good stuff to crack open next week in singing his songs. But now we have to get to the topic at hand, Phil. And the topic at hand is what? We talked about it already. Hunters of color. And kind of the demographics of the hunting community. And this is something that, Phil, would you agree that I think everybody comes into already a little bit charged? You kind of already have your own way of seeing this issue, the issue of diversity in the outdoors, diversity in our society.
Hackles up, no matter which side you fall on.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. And I was telling you before we hit record that you asked me how this went. And I said, it was beautiful in that it is also very bland. there is not any contentious nature to it. Jimmy and Lydia from Hunters of Color have an awesome story. They're wonderful people. They just are looking for empathy and understanding of the position that they are in and other hunters of color are in. They understand the facts about the demographics, and they want to do something about it. This is not a conversation about social engineering. It is a conversation about what we can actually do to fix what is a very objective issue within our space. There's no grandstanding. There's no pushing people to believe what you believe. It is a very objective, hey, look, here's a problem. Here are the numbers, which you'll hear about coming up. And here is how these two people want to address this issue in our space. And so, you know, if we wanted to be a bombastic podcast that pissed everybody off and got a bunch of controversy, I don't think this one is it. Although there'll be a lot of people that call us woke and get mad at us just for doing this, as seems to be common. But this is a conversation where two good people are trying to make a difference, and they're not just talking about it, they're actually doing it. So that's how I see it. I don't see a whole lot, you know, to disagree with here. That very much goes to Hunters of Color as an organization that's young, but it also goes to the year of the new hunter, having mentors and understanding that it's kind of one step at a time towards the diversity I think anybody objectively should want for the outdoors, because that diversity means more people doing what we love to do and supporting us and touting us and coming to this thing. You'll hear, of course, my analogy about I want to have a town with more diversity. As I walk down the streets, I want to see an eclectic group of people doing what I do. Unlike that dude in Minnesota, I don't want everybody to look like me, because that's not interesting. That's boring. And so that's how I believe we can shape this conversation with Jimmy and Lydia. They are awesome people, and we're going to continue to work with them because I think they have a really good handle on what we're doing here. So, Phil, any thoughts? I know this is something that you like to do. This kind of conversation is something that you've seen is very, very good and very valuable in the past.
Yeah, I mean, it's just very easy, and not even just with the topic of minorities in the hunting space, but in literally anything in your life. It's much easier to turn a blind eye to something that doesn't directly affect you. Just pretend it doesn't exist. But this absolutely does affect you, and I think it's really important to think about the people whom it does affect directly, and just hear their perspective and their point of view, and just be a little bit open to empathy, and think about what steps, small or large, you can take in your life to keep hunting and the outdoors thriving and a welcoming place for everyone.
Now, I will say, look, these topics can be fraught, but they can also be relatively simple as the way we approach them. That's the way I look at it. I mean, I look at this as a very easy equation to suss out, and you'll hear that in detail here in a minute, but it's a very easy equation to look at. We objectively have a dominant percentage of the hunting culture that is one skin color and one gender, really, too. I'm not blaming that on anybody. I'm not asking anybody to feel bad about that or feel sorry for that, but I'm asking an open ear for change. And Lydia and Jimmy are asking you for empathy to their situation. And you'll hear in a minute some micro and macro examples of how this looks on a broad statistical level, how it has become what it is now, and then on a very personal level, how it impacts people who are both mentors and mentees, veteran hunters and new hunters, how this personally impacts hunters of color out there in the world. And so we'll get into it. We'll delve into it. Everybody will come in, hopefully with all their baggage sloughed off, and listen very closely to the words that Jimmy and Lydia have to say. And we'll take it from there with this conversation, which will not stop. We will continue it when we can pick it up in a constructive way. So please enjoy Hunters of Color founders Jimmy and Lydia. Jimmy and Lydia, how's it going?
Good. How are you, Ben?
Couldn't be better. We were just talking about weather differences. It's cold and sunny here. You guys are telling me you're in Oregon. What's going on? Probably, can I guess that it's raining?
Good guess. It's a constant drizzle here in the Willamette Valley of Oregon.
Oh, that's a beautiful place. I have some friends that are from near there. What is the first question I have for you among many things? What's the hunting season look like? You guys, turkey hunters, bear hunters, like how does it line out for you at current time?
So I'm the resident hunter here. Lydia is going to be my mentee for this year. And right now I'm waiting on my spring bear hunt results to come up. They should be available in 2 days. And then our spring turkey season starts up in April. So waiting on a bear tag and turkey tag.
Me too. Me too. Similar. So Lydia, never hunted, hunt curious. Jimmy's making you do it. You tell us the truth here.
So yeah, basically a little bit of everything. I grew up fishing and camping, and I grew up in the state of Oregon. So everything's outdoors, everything. Mm-hmm. So very comfortable outside, done everything but hunting basically. And I grew up in a hunting family. So I was kind of the odd one out as far as the rest of my family goes. And then when Jimmy started up this, Jimmy and I started up Hunters of Color, Jimmy, his whole platform wanted to be a mentorship program. And we were talking to Chad Brown out of Portland. He runs Soul River Inc. and Love is King, Free to Roam. Mm-hmm. And he brought up the idea that we have to have a proof of concept. And so Jimmy said, "Hey, Lydia, why don't you be our proof of concept? I will mentor you." Because if I were to go out right now and try to go turkey hunting, I wouldn't have the first idea even how to buy a tag or a license, or do I wear camo? Like, do I wear, you know what I mean? Do I have to paint my face camo? So, yep. So that's basically how we got into it. I'm really excited.
That's awesome. Yeah, we have our engineer, my co-host, as it were, our beloved Phil, the engineer on this show. He is going to take his first turkey hunt with me in May. So we have been working through, he took his hunter safety last fall, and then we've been working through gun safety, and we're going to get in as soon as it warms up here, we'll be out on public lands shooting shotguns, learning about how they work and stuff. Where are you guys at in that process? Have you done the prerequisites at hunter safety and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so one of our first dates, so Lydia and I are a couple, one of our first dates took Lydia out shooting. It's kind of like my test for her. to see how she handled a gun, and she knew where to point it, where to leave the chamber unloaded all the time. And so I knew that she had safety background. And so we kind of just refined those skills that she had. And I think the next step is just for her to get herself mentally prepared to take a life and procure meat.
So I already do archery too. So cool. That is definitely on the table. I know that it would be easier with a gun, but it's definitely on the table too, to go archery turkey hunting.
Yeah. Is there anything that you've worked through thus far? I mean, obviously sometimes the killing of the animals is either the first thing you think about and the last thing you do in hunting. And so have you thought through that yet? Have you guys talked about how to prepare for that moment?
So there's a reason that we're starting with turkeys.
I think I know the reason.
So I've fished my entire life and I know how to kill a fish. I'm really good at it and I have no problem with it. And I also understand the value of living beings and respecting life, all lives. And turkeys, for some reason, maybe just because they're not fluffy and cute like Bambi, it's easier for me to do that, to transition that way. And hopefully I can get up to the bigger game at some point. But that's probably what you were going to guess, huh?
Exactly. Yeah, you're not alone. I think that is I'm not sure. I think it's the looks thing. I think when you get out in the field, you'll find a certain respect for them, spending a lot of time trying to get them close to you. But that is a very common thought, that turkeys is the easiest because they don't have those doughy eyes looking at you. They're just, man, they're beautiful in some ways and not so much in others. So I totally understand. Is that going to be the first hunt? Have you guys talked about exactly what the first hunt's going to be?
Yeah. So I have, a couple properties here that have like a resident flock or herd of turkey of a few hundred strong. And last year when I went out, it took me 5 minutes after setting up the blind to get one with my bow. So I'm hoping that, it's as easy or not as easy, but, I'm hoping that Lydia finds success, in a short period of time. Whereas, I mean, it took me a few years to even bag my first turkey. So,
yep. Yeah, isn't that the thing that you're trying to weigh, right? How quickly do you want to find success? Because some of that hardship is what makes that success feel good. So in Philly Engineer's case, I'm going to take him out like 7 days to where there's no turkeys at all. And we're going to hike up to like sheep territory. He's going to be confused, but it's for his own good.
Yeah, I'm leaning towards that too. Maybe we'll go hike in along the beach or something like that. And then we'll drive back to Corvallis and
yeah. I mean, everything for you guys is a date, so it's just time together until time to pull the trigger.
That's true. It might be a little bit more romantic than you and Phil's outing.
Well, we're pretty close. he knows that. He actually helped us get this together. He's in the background just doing the tech work. So we got a lot to talk about. It's good for people to get to know you. So Jimmy, since I feel like, I don't know if you call yourself the original founder, if you guys are both co-founders of Hunters of Color, but give us how that came about. We kind of got a little bit of an inkling of where that came from, but how that came about and why you feel it needed to come about.
Let's start from the beginning. I was born and raised in Sonoma Valley, California. My dad he's ex-military, sharpshooter in the military. And so I was raised around guns, had a really strong understanding of gun safety, and respect for life. And it wasn't until I was 8 years old when, a family friend invited out me and my dad on a duck hunt. And, we were sitting out in the middle of Central Valley, California, where a set of mallards cupped their wings in and set in the decoys. And, my dad shot his first duck. And at that point I was hooked. I was like, this is something that I want to do. And so I pressured my dad and let me take the hunter safety at 9 years old in California. And then, spent the next couple years, trying to get my first deer, got my first deer at 12. So growing up in California, there's a lot of anti-hunting sentiment, to begin with. And then on top of that, as I started to try to find friends to hunt with, when I got into high school, I started to realize that like no one looked like me. No one was Hispanic. No one was Pacific Islander. And so I started asking friends if they wanted to go out with me. My best friend's Mexican. He was like, well, man, that's not something we do here. Even though his dad used to hunt in Mexico all the time. So I was like, that's kind of weird that you would think that it's not for you. Or at least your people don't do this. And so I kind of brushed it off. And then it wasn't until, the Is Hunting Too White article came out that I saw the statistics and dove into those and was like, wow, my observations growing up are 100% valid. As I dug into these, I dug into the research, I kind of found that there was no organizations working on, doing R3 or, diversity and inclusion for the outdoors. There had been some pledges that some CEOs took, but there was no nonprofits. There was nothing set up, no organization to kind of correct this. So I looked into it. I originally thought that I wanted to try to get inner city youth out on their first hunts. But then after this article came out, I realized that, well, it's not just inner city youth. It's everybody. It's people who live out in the country who want to hunt, but just don't know how to get into it. So that's where Hunters of Color started. Lydia, one day I've been talking about it for like a year. And so she got tired of me talking about it. And so one day I came back from work and she was like, hey, here you go. Here's the URL, huntersofcolor.com. Here's the Instagram handle and all the other social media handles. Have at it. Do what you will with it. And so originally we thought we were going to be a shirt company. But then we realized, well, we need to actually do more than just making shirts. We need to start an organization. So that's why we went the nonprofit route, and here we are today.
Yeah, you guys are a 501c3.
So we applied for 501c3 status in December of 2020, pretty early on in December, and then apparently it's been taking months for people to get their official exempt status from the IRS. So we are still waiting and supposedly going to hear back by March 11th of this year. So
The government. I was reading on your website, you guys have only really been doing this since August, right? I mean, we're only talking about 6 or 8 months and already have, you know, thousands of people connected with you on social media. That's no small feat. That's not something that I want to take a few steps back, obviously, and talk about some of the broader topics you brought up there. But it's no small feat to step out like you did. And you're right. There's not a lot of people in our space that are stepping out in the way that you have and declaring things that you declared. But then also, you know, gather together that many thousands of people. I don't know what the number is now. I can look. It's over 6,000. Is that right?
Yeah, just under 7.
Yeah. So, you know, we'll just call it 7. We'll round up. Maybe we can get you there off of this podcast. You know, just under 6,000 people or under 7,000 people in what turns to 8 months. Have you sat and thought about that? Obviously, you know, Instagram has its own algorithms and things that help growth, but that your message, do you feel like is connecting in a way that is broader than you thought, or is there something else at play?
Yeah, I don't think that we were necessarily surprised that people support this mission, especially because we are the only organization that's doing this. There are a lot of organizations that are helping women get into hunting. There are a lot of organizations that do like brown folks fishing, like that kind of thing. But we are the only people of color run, people of color based nonprofit organization hoping to break barriers for people of color to get into hunting. So I think that the lack of other organizations doing the same thing, people are seeing us and being like, oh, that's cool. I'm surprised we're like, wow, we're surprised it took this long for someone to do this.
Yeah. Have you felt energy around that, you know, from your peers and other people that are reaching out? Have you felt that this has created kind of a buzz, at least in a small way?
Yeah. We've had an overwhelming amount of positive feedback so far. And especially from other hunters of color, a lot of people were saying like, wow, I wish this thing was around when I was just starting to get into it, or I wish I could have looked at an Instagram page and seen that my people do this kind of thing. So yeah, a lot of positive feedback so far.
We also get a lot of positive feedback too from people who are interested in being allies or interested in learning more. We got a message from someone just this last week who was like, hey, I'm white, but your page has educated me so much. And I'm so grateful that this exists because, and he told a story about trying to take his friend who was black out hunting. And for some reason he couldn't understand the trepidations. He was like, why wouldn't you want to go hunting? Why are you afraid? Or, you know, why do you feel timid to get out in the woods with me? And then his friend explained some hard situations, some hard racism, real racism that he's experienced in the woods. And the guy who messaged us was like, I didn't want to believe it, but I had no choice because I love my friend and I need to listen and be a good friend, you know? Mm. And then he said, when he found our page, he was like, oh, okay. Like this, it validates the experience that other people that he knows have had in the woods and in the ponds and marshes.
I think that as we go along here in this conversation, I feel that that's the most powerful way to communicate this. Certainly, I'll read some statistics here from, as you mentioned, Pat Durkin's article on our website back in May of 2019. I believe, let me get that right. Yep, May 17th of 2019. So if you want to find that, go to meateater.com and search "Is Hunting Too White." You'll find it. There's lots of broad statistics there. And those, I think, back up a lot of what you guys are doing and saying and stuff we've said on this show in the past as well. But then we have to really then connect that from the macro to the micro, which is people's personal stories. And I feel that it's everyone's job if they want to take up this task, and I certainly do, of finding ways to remove roadblocks for everyone to get into hunting. And I think this is just one of those things that we have to do to remove those roadblocks. So let me read you guys. I know you guys know these stats well, but let me just read for those that don't, some of the stats in Pat Durkin's article from 2019. He said from 2010 to 2014, the USDA Forest Service reports whites made up 95% of all visits to national forests. A National Park Service study in 2018 found whites made up 80% of visits to National Park Service parks and monuments. A 2017 report by the Coleman Company on camping participation found whites accounted for 80% of campers. In a 2018 study, the Outdoor Foundation found whites accounted for nearly 3/4 of all outdoor recreation. And then to get into the hunting space specifically, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service most recent participation study found 11.5 million Americans hunted at least once in 2016. Of those hunters, 96% were white and 3% were Hispanic. Blacks and Asians made up most of the remaining 1%, but at levels too low to pinpoint participation rates. And so I could keep on going. There's more numbers. But they all kind of paint a similar picture that the bulk of the people that that we see outside are of a single skin color. So we can start with that. That's just the data. That has nothing to do with anything societal or political. It is purely what we are seeing and what we must address. Any other numbers you guys want to add to that or perspective to those broader the broader context?
Well, yeah, I want to kind of go back into what you said before you started talking about the statistics, and the statistics are very powerful. And I think that the key here, like you said, is recognizing people's experiences, right? And listening and empathy. I think that if there's a word that we can, if I could suggest to listeners or to anyone entering this conversation, it's to have empathy and to have grace and to listen to each other, because, you know, we all come from different perspectives, and just because you haven't seen something or experienced something doesn't mean that it isn't affecting people. And as long as human beings are being affected by something, we all ought to care and listen. And as long as nature is being affected by something, we all ought to care and listen. And the statistics too, I think that, like you said, It's not political. It's not meant to be divisive. And statistics are exactly that. Statistics. They're as Jimmy's an engineer, so he always talks about how there are some things that are just facts and it's not an opinion. It's the actual data itself. So that shouldn't offend anyone, and it really shouldn't scare anyone either. I don't think the statistics say anything. It's the history that we need to look at, though, that does speak to that. Like the national park statistics, for example, that you mentioned, national parks were segregated until the 1950s. And it was illegal for Black people to go to national parks or visit white sections of national parks. So there's history like that that we often, most people don't know about, most people don't talk about. And there's no reason why we shouldn't talk about it, because the history that we don't know is the building blocks for where we live today and what we inherited as today's America and today's hunting sphere and the outdoors world.
Yeah, that's well put. I mean, we've struggled with how to use history in this context to represent what we do now and what we do in the future. People struggle with that. I think there are some latent guilt in a lot of places, but also people that just want to help and they don't want to have to be of one political ideology or another to help. I've heard that from a lot of people. I just want to help people get into hunting no matter what, where they come from, who they are. So I think that recognition is the first part. And what I think you said, Lydia, is maybe the most impactful, and something that I've learned is everybody's perspective is going to be different on this. Jimmy, you told a pretty a brief but powerful story of your friend saying, we just don't do this. It's not something that we do here. Maybe it's because you're in California, but I suspect not. There's a lot of hunters in California. It's because of where you grew up and the people you're around and your heritage, and the color of your skin has a huge part of that. So I think we start by recognizing that, not, like you said, not being scared of it or afraid of it, not being triggered by it. I hate to use that word, but it's true. And moving toward it with some courage. And it sounds like, do you guys feel like it takes a little courage to step into this, or this is just innate to who you are? I mean, what's the feeling stepping into this conversation?
Well, one thing that really helps understand where or why the statistics got to where they are today is understanding the history of it. I mean, it all started with removing Native Americans from their ancestral hunting grounds. So that's, I mean, if you start there and then you go follow history, you kind of see this trend where this country was designed with the white man in mind. You even look at like some of my heroes, like Thoreau and Roosevelt and Muir. I grew up just down the road from John Muir Woods in Marin County, and if you look into them, they were pretty biased in who they wanted or they're designing these outdoor spaces for. So if you start with history, you kind of understand where the statistics come from. But yeah, I think everybody can dive into the history and kind of learn for themselves, kind of have more empathy for where people and hunters of color come from.
Yeah. No, I agreed. I think, and like I said, I would refer folks back to our last conversation. Everyone that listens to the show weekly will remember our conversation with Dr. Carolyn Finney. She wrote a book called Black Faces and White Spaces. And it was powerful to hear some of the history that I didn't even know about John Muir specifically. She did some performance art around her relationship with John Muir, both of respect and really damnation. At some level, there's a duality in that feeling about the outdoors that it both inspires people but sets a feeling in them of segregation and of hate and of something that was separate for so long. So I think you can, you know, I don't want to focus there all that much, not to say it's not important, but I want to find, you know, really find a way to, as you just said, Jimmy, tell people, go look at the history. It's not hard to find. There are many good resources. We spoke about some of the resources, even in the Second Amendment community a couple of weeks ago with Ian Harrison on this program. So there's a lot of resources. Do you guys have resources where you would refer people that where they can to get some of this information or get the perspective that maybe you've gotten over the years as you learned?
So we're actually building up a resource page specifically for our mentors. We want mentors in the Hunters of Color organization to be both safe, as any hunting organization would expect their mentors to be, and committed to empathy and anti-racism and community. And so we're building up not only the history, like Carolyn Finney wrote like her book, but also just basic understandings of how to listen to each other, how to have empathy for each other, and how to share our perspectives in a respectful way. And I know Jimmy had something he wanted to add to that.
Well, I always say if you remove anybody from anything for one generation, it's really hard to get into it. This kind of moves into like, how do we solve the problem? But yeah, I always say that if you remove anybody from it one generation, it's really hard to get back into that one thing. So if you're removed from hunting for one generation and your grandfather, your father don't hunt, then you become a person who has to be self-taught, or you look for somebody who's going to mentor you.
Yeah. Yeah. Patrilineal descent is huge in hunting. It is one of the things that we celebrate without pause. I celebrate it every day because I was sitting in my office right now looking at a picture of my dad and I from when I was 10 years old with fond memories. But anyone who doesn't have that experience comes to it in a different way. We have a new term. We started with adult onset hunters on this show, as everyone else. We've erased that. We're no longer using that. It sounds like something that you picked up and you don't want. So we're talking about emergent hunters is our new, we're going to change that term. And I think that's really a part of what we're talking about here too. This happens across the spectrum, but it happens just with more weight in hunters of color, you know, more things to explore, more barriers that are perceived and not tangible. And those are things that I think we can all recognize. Now, if you're not so inclined to recognize those differences and those perceptions about the outdoors, you may run into, like you said, your friend did, bringing a person of color into the outdoors and them being uncomfortable when you take them there and having no understanding of why they are uncomfortable. And so anyone out there listening may want to not address this or not think about it or call it woke. That's okay. But you may run into it and when you try to broach this topic and try to bring someone out. So I hope you're listening to this to be a part of opening eyes and bringing people along. So
yeah,
go ahead, Lydia.
Oh, I was just going to say that's part of how we are building hunters of color, because there's a difference between saying you're welcome here and this was made for you. And so if there is an understanding that the outdoors weren't made for certain people, or hunting isn't made for certain people, like Jimmy's friend Raul had said to him when they were little, that's obviously got to change somehow, because our whole slogan is that the outdoors are for everyone. And the point behind our name, Hunters of Color, one of our first Instagram posts was, why do you have to see color? Why do we have to talk about it in this perspective? Mm-hmm. And I think that I do want to add that some of these barriers aren't necessarily perceived. Some of them are very tangible and very real, such as the fact that 98% of the land that's owned in the United States is owned by white people. And when I say things like that too, I hope that people know that that isn't a condemnation. That isn't a bad thing in and of itself. The bad thing is that white people make up like 60% of the United States. Mm-hmm. And so what about the rest of us? You know, that is the problem. It's not the fact that white people own land. It's that, what about the rest of us? Especially when we want to go hunting. Because obviously you need land to hunt, and we're blessed out here to have lots of public land, but some states are not so lucky.
The challenge here with our political environment, and we've talked about this on the show as well this year, is that even a topic like this doesn't seem inclusive, because a lot of people want to just say, I don't see color, I don't care about this topic. This topic isn't for me. I don't want to be forced into anything. I never did anything to hurt anyone. And I'm a white guy. I see those. I hear those things. I understand those things. But again, you kind of have a choice to make here.
Yeah, I always say, if you don't see color, or you didn't do anything wrong, I say good for you, but help end these barriers. Have a part in ending these things that some people feel, because it's the love of humanity that we're trying to reach out. And I love your neighbor. It's just,
yeah.
So yeah, basically what Jimmy always says too, even if you didn't do anything, even if you weren't a slave owner, even if you didn't hurt anybody, you can make a difference in making the outdoors more inclusive.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think as we really, like, one of the tenets of telling good story, and one of the tenets of journalism, and one of the tenets of really objective thinking is searching for truth. As we talked about at the beginning, and we can read the statistics. That is true. Those statistics are as true gets. And then we can learn from each other, those personal experiences, those also are true. And so I would just say, I get it. A lot of people who don't agree have probably already turned this off, and that's okay. But the folks that are still hanging in there, we're going to get to the point where we tell you what Lydia and Jimmy are doing. But I think that question that you guys got is probably a question that most people get stepping out in this arena. Why has it got to be about color? And here's one analogy that I've been using on the show for a long time, which is, if hunting was a town, right? If hunting was a place in Oregon where you could go and visit, and it had a tourism board, and it had a downtown with shops, and 90-some% of those shops, and the streets of the town, and everywhere you went, there was one culture, one color, it wouldn't feel like a welcoming place for people that weren't in that group. So if we want to make the hunting, the place of hunting, the community of hunting, if we were to make it tangible today, flip a switch and make it tangible, we would start from a very diverse place. We can't do that. We're starting from a place that isn't diverse. And, you know, somebody like you guys walking around on the streets of our town, you might not feel welcome. And if we would make a step to improve that, we can't go back in time and erase all that's happened to this point, but we can open up our streets to the people that want to see themselves reflected in our town. In this big long analogy, that's probably confusing at this point, but that's how I generally think about it, and that's how I've tried to approach it. And I hope that at least conversations like this can make a difference.
I think that's a beautiful way of putting it, and it made sense to me. I didn't think it was too drawn out, but I also, when you said that, there are towns in Oregon that are like that. There's, you know, my cousin was hunting with my other cousin in Eastern Oregon. One of them is a person of color and the other one is white. And in a little small town, they went to a grocery store, and my cousin, who is a person of color, got followed around by the security guard the entire time he was in the store. And my cousin who's white didn't. And it really pissed both of them off. And it's just something, another one of those things that it's like, you don't understand that it's happening until it happens to you or someone you love. And so it shouldn't have to come to that, right? We should be able to have these conversations and love each other, love one another, and spread love and empathy in these conversations.
Well, I think we've touched on kind of what we can do as people in the community, because I think that's a huge part of this. And a lot of this is just that empathy that you talked about, Lydia. But you guys also have a tangible thing that you're doing. And so I guess I would first say that I definitely know that I want for people of color to see themselves reflected in our community as prominently as we can. Now, that brings up its own tokenism conversation. It is as fraught as anything else, but I still believe firmly that people want to see themselves reflected in the outdoors and reflected in hunting. So we have to do that. But what is the thing that you guys are doing tangibly? I know you have mentors and mentees. How have you kind of set up that model to do something real and on the ground to grow diversity in hunting?
Yeah, I want to touch on one last thing.
Sure.
There's one thing where people say, like, well, why should I care? So something that's touched in on the article too is that the census says that by the year 2044, the U.S. will be a majority minority people. And so when you look at current trends, if we aren't recruiting people of color into hunting, then you're going to see this huge die-off, or not die-off, but you're going to see a huge decline in the number of hunters that are participating and then giving money towards conservation efforts. And so the North American model of conservation will inevitably have to change because of that. And so instead of getting to that point, we should try to stomp it out now, or at least address it now, so that we don't have to readdress how we conserve our wild resources here in the United States.
Absolutely.
One person who I talked to, you recently had him on, is Ian from the Carnivore magazine. And he wanted to highlight us in his magazine. But he mentioned, oh yeah, like in the UK, hunting is a very, an aristocratic, kind of elite class, activity. And I think the reason why he came to the United States, or at least what he told me, is because it isn't that, and anybody can get into it. There are certain barriers to entry, but if you do push past those, you can be in the hunting community. That's all I had to say on that. But
yeah.
So what we're tangibly doing with Hunters of Color is we have a mentoring program set up where we're planning on having like a network of mentors spread out across the country, where if anybody who has interest and needs somebody to teach them, like they don't have somebody within their immediate circle to teach them how to hunt, but they have interest in procuring their own meat, going outdoors, we will set them up with somebody who is qualified, trained, and safe for them to go out into the woods with. And it could start out with just a hike, or maybe just a beer conversation. And then it will eventually, hopefully, we get to the point where our mentees become mentors.
Yeah. And do you guys feel like this is, how would you describe it? Are you trying to start a movement? Are you trying to take it one hunter at a time? What's the mission in your own minds? I know, you know, everybody has their website about section, but as you guys think of the next 3 to 5 years, what's in your head?
So our ultimate vision, which I don't think is actually on our website, our mission statement certainly is, but our ultimate vision is to have a world where our organization doesn't need to exist. So it sounds kind of counterproductive, but I think you probably get the gist of it, right? If hunting demographics matched the demographics in our nation, then we wouldn't be having to do this push to try to get more people of color into hunting.
Yep. Right?
And so that's
can we stop there a second?
Yeah.
That is the most important thing that I've heard anybody say in any of these conversations. And it comes to the thing where this is emotional for you guys because you've experienced it, and there's people around you that have experienced it. We can move through those emotions and get to what you just said, which is important. We look at the numbers, we see there's a problem. We want to address this problem, but once we've addressed it to the point where it sits even with the culture of our society, and we can all agree that we have progressed and are progressing and moving in the right direction, there's no need to continue it. Because I think really what I think that does is help people think of it objectively.
Right.
And that is an important thing that I always push for situations like this when people get emotional about a certain topic. I think just that comment, Lydia, is, I think, powerful just in its objectivity.
Right. Yeah. And that is the ultimate goal, hopefully, in any conversation, right? And obviously, people with different perspectives everyone has bias. but yeah, hopefully, that is the end goal. And that we don't exist kind of sounds funny, but it's the truth.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to have to tackle this huge problem myself, but I love my community of hunters, and I love my community of fellow people of color. And I want both to be able to enjoy the outdoors, or I want them both to be together. It can only get better when they're together. So, my drive behind doing this, and I'm doing it for the love of both nature and people. So,
yeah, I mean, there's so many stories of this. There's a gentleman named Dennis. I don't know if I'm going to give Dennis his last name, but this would have been, and I talked to Dennis over Instagram a little bit. This would have been back in what, September of last year.
We won't
give Dennis's last name. You guys can share his Instagram if you'd like to. But Dennis was African American, and he was hunting in Florida. Actually, let me just let you guys say the details because you know it better than I. Can you tell us a story of Dennis and what he posted to Instagram and kind of what that started online?
Yeah. So, I mean, I was at work and I got this message from a follower on Instagram, and they said, "Hey, you should probably check this out." So I opened it up, and it was a series of videos of Dennis. He was up in a deer stand. He's a new hunter. He is archery hunting for his first time. He was working with a landowner and got permission to hunt deer on the property. While he was up in the tree, an aggravated person realized that he was hunting on either nearby property that he had permission to hunt, or I don't know the exact scenario, but he started to play obscene racist music, started yelling at him, telling him get out of the tree, calling him all these obscenities. And Dennis, you could, in his voice, you can hear him just breaking down. I've never experienced anything like this before, and I think he handled it like a true gentleman. And even at one point, he talks about how he's a first responder, and if he got a call to go save that man right now, he would hop out of the tree and go help that man out. But he says that this man probably wouldn't do the same for him because of the color of his skin. And I was at work, and I broke down. I was like, this needs to stop. We need to share this. And so we reached out to him. We ended up sharing it because he gave us permission, and the community stepped up. It was really nice to see that the community of hunting was so against what had happened to him that they uplifted him to the point where he wasn't going to quit hunting, and he was going to be a lifelong hunter. And we get pictures from him every once in a while, and he always a huge smile on his face. And I mean, we're grateful for the way he handled the situation, and I think he's grateful for us for showing that stuff like this does happen right now. It's 2019, or it was 2020, and it happened. So you can say, "Oh, well, it's distant past," but no, it happened a few months ago.
And I think for every video like that of Dennis that we have, there's a video that didn't get recorded or that didn't get posted, you know? And there's people with fears of things like that happening to them in the woods. And I doubt that, Ben, you've ever thought, "Oh no, I don't want to go hunting because someone might be racist towards me," you know?
Yeah.
And so that's something that I think is another way to have empathy and think, wow, that would really suck to have to think about that, have to consider that very real possibility when you're just trying to go out in the woods, when your number one concern should be getting an animal.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, the definition of community is, you know, it talks about a shared common attitude, interest and goals, feeling of fellowship. I mean, you look in the dictionary, Webster will tell you, you know, and so when you think about community, we can build a community around hunting, are building a community around hunting that has to do with those interests and goals and attitudes. I mean, if you're a member of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, you're gathering together around the idea that public land is for everybody. Really, at some level, if you're a part of a Second Amendment group, you're gathering around the idea that the Second Amendment is for everyone. That's easy to say, but it's not easy to create. We certainly haven't done a great job of creating that in the space that I spend my life working in. So we really aren't the definition of a community in the tangible sense. I feel like I share interests with you guys, and then as soon as Lydia kills a turkey, we're going to share even more interests together. But I would just rather talk about turkeys, but we can't right now. We can't ignore what this topic brings to the fore. So that's how I, you know, examples like Dennis's are certainly his. If you haven't seen that, certainly you can go to the Hunters of Color Instagram page, scroll down, you'll find it. And you'll find some content about Dennis. But when you see a grown man in tears and as emotional as he was, it makes it real for everybody. Because he certainly didn't. All he asked to do is go sit in a tree stand and have a good time. And that was, it didn't turn out that way, that's for sure. So it's just, it's hard to ignore at this point for me, and it should be hard to ignore for anyone else. I know companies in our, have you seen companies and folks in the hunting industry of prominence reaching out more and more, trying to bring you guys in? I know you mentioned Ian was talking to you. He's a limey bastard, but I love him. So apologize that he had to represent us. But have you had other encouraging conversations with companies or individuals that you see in the hunting space?
So Hunt to Eat was really big in with the Dennis when that video came out. And they kind of took the reins on doing something for him because we at that point were only just getting started off. A few other companies reached out. I know Ryan Callahan reached out and offered him to come hunt with him in Louisiana. There's a few other big names. For the most part, companies really didn't do much. As a side note, the most prominent thing that we're working on right now is we're working with the Nature Conservancy, who owns millions of acres across the United States.
Yeah.
They are working with us, BHA and NDA, to set up a mentorship or one of our programs on their properties. So they're opening up their gates, and it's starting off in New York State. And then hopefully we spread across the country. And with that, we're building this community of mentors and mentees. And I think that's what it's all about. We're building a community that anybody who's interested in hunting can look to hunters of color and be interested and see that, oh yeah, this is what my people do.
Yeah. I think that's return to it. If people can see themselves reflected in this and then meet people close to them that they can learn to trust, that do what we do. Those are two huge steps. I think that, here on this show, we proclaimed back in when we did our first show this year that this is the year of the new hunter. We renamed Adult Onset Hunter. We're taking Phil T. Engineer on his first hunt, and we're really trying to understand every avenue into helping new hunters that are already there. Because as you guys probably know, COVID is creating a lot of new hunters. a lot of people are like, I just got to go outside and it'd be nice to eat when I'm done. So a lot of that going on, and it's good to have you guys involved in that. Do you guys have a lot of mentors out there in the field already? Is there anything that anyone listening can do to help either be a mentor themselves or point folks in your direction? What's the best thing that people can do, and what are they joining when they join?
Yeah, so we already have 30 mentors in 18 states. Which is super exciting because we just opened up the application process like 2 weeks ago or something like that. Wow. So an outpouring of support, which has been validating and amazing and really encouraging too, in building that community that you talked about. And I like the dictionary definition you brought up. It's also part of the building blocks of this organization. I'm a history major, so my whole context comes from, studied civil rights history. So my whole context comes from, that perspective. And the idea of MLK's beloved community or Malcolm X's, the brotherhood of humanity, you know, that we're all there for each other. And if like what you said, the hunting community doesn't reflect that truth right now, at least hunters of color is trying to reflect that truth. And then eventually, like we said, hopefully we won't exist at some point.
Well, you got to start somewhere, right? I mean, you have to start somewhere, and we are where we are. So we have to do something. And you guys are taking action, and that's what's admirable.
Yeah. And if people want to help, the application is up on our website. It's huntersofcolor.com. Soon it'll be huntersofcolor.org. Once the government gets back to us.
Hey, is there any emails you want to give out for listeners of the show to email anybody in the 501c3 department that we can say, like, get it done? Come on.
They kind of lost our application too. and so we had to call them and tell them to find it.
Bastards.
Yeah.
They're not really bastards. They're fine people.
Yeah. but so there's that way you can help us. And if you know anybody who wants to be mentored, have them fill out our mentorship application too. And I mean, hopefully we are creating a system where, yeah, I mentioned it earlier, where the mentees eventually become mentors and this community continues to build. And, yeah, this is just the start of it. So we're 6 months in and, it's been great so far.
Yeah. I mean, there truly are no small actions, especially at in this time where people are looking for things to gather around. We're looking for things, for ways to be, maybe we're not looking for things, but on this show, we're looking for things. Well, maybe not all of us, but I am looking for things to gather around, looking for ideas that are easily understood and easily celebrated. And I think this is one of them, regardless of how other folks see it or might label it. I truly do feel this is as simple of an effort as you could possibly make it, but also an impactful one as well. So, man, it's good to see you out there. Are you guys? You guys are millennials, right? You're younger. You don't have to say your age.
We're on the cusp.
I think I'm whatever the one before millennial is. Hopefully.
Well, I'm like an old millennial, so I'm 30. Yeah, maybe
I guess I don't really know how it works.
Yeah, I'm like the oldest millennial ever. Like an old man. But I mean, it's this generational thing too, as you guys said, both with race and Jim Crow and the changes we've seen and celebrated over the last two decades to how when you're in your early 20s right now, how you see the world and the world you experience is so much different than the world that your parents experienced at that same age.
Absolutely. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
We were just talking about, my dad was born in the 50s. And so whenever I read anything about civil rights, I'm like, hey dad, what was that like when that happened? you know?
And I make fun of my dad. I'm like, hey dad, what about the typewriter when that came out? What was that like? Yeah. Remember the printing press?
You remember the dinosaurs?
Yeah. I could tell you impactful stories that I've heard, not from my dad, but from other folks in my dad's age range about schools being segregated and the stories and perspectives from young white males at the time and not really knowing anything different than segregation. And we've had Charles Rodney is a man we've had on this show. He's a 71-year-old rabbit hunter from Maryland. He's African American and he grew up actually in the Jim Crow South in Louisiana, the son of a sharecropper. He grew up in poverty. He couldn't swim in the same swimming pools as the white kids, and he struggled with that throughout his life, but he overcame it and now is had a successful life, lives in Maryland, has three successful children, and has overcame where he started. So I think he's a great analogy for where we need to go as a hunting community. We need to overcome where we are right now and every roadblock. I certainly am glad you guys are kicking them down, and I will kick them down right there with you. So
Thank you, Ben.
I guess that's a pledge. I don't know what you call that.
No, yeah, that's good. That's what we're looking for, that kind of support. And also, I think that, like you brought up, it's not ancient history, the stuff that we're talking about, right? It's people that you're having on the podcast are talking about what it was like growing up in the South during these times and all over the country during civil rights. And I think that helps people to gain empathy and gain perspective. Because, you know, what affected our parents and what affected our grandparents still affects us today. And it's what we inherited today. And, you know, while we can't change what happened in the past, we're responsible for what happens in the future. So exactly. Hopefully we can be a positive change.
Yep. The last thing I'll say about this, because I got to run, but the last thing I'll say is if another human is seeking empathy from you and you deny them, you're what they call an asshole. So, you know, I love that you use the word empathy. I think it's one of the most important things that we can have as a characteristic, both individually, but as a community. And the desire for it, I think, is as true as the lack of it in some places. So I really do appreciate you guys. Give everybody the exact details. Hunters of Color on Instagram, huntersofcolor.com. Anything else they need to know before we get out of here?
Now just give us a follow, sign up to be a mentor. If that's something that you think you want to do, if you know anybody who wants to get into hunting, have them fill out the mentee application, and spread the word. It's going to take an army to make the world that we envision. So we're welcoming everybody who is on board with us.
If you have questions, or if you want to talk to us or bug us, or if you're mad about something that we said, please send us an email. You don't have to bug Ben about it.
Oh, bug me. Bug me. I like it. Let me go ahead.
My email is Lydia@huntersofcolor, and Jimmy's is Jimmy@huntersofcolor. Facebook.com. So pretty easy to get a hold of us if you want to talk.
All right. Easy to remember. And here's the other thing I'll promise to you guys. You pick a mentor and mentee from your list that have a great story of a hunt together, and you tell me who they are, and we'll have them on the show, and we'll hear their story, and we'll talk to them about what they went through and the good and the bad, and we'll continue to get this message out there. Does that sound good?
Awesome.
Sounds awesome.
All right. Well, keep in touch, guys, and thank you on behalf of all of us for what you're doing.
Thanks, Ben.
See ya. That's it. That's all. Another episode in the books. Thank you to Hunters of Color founders, Jimmy and Lydia, for coming and talking to me. We had a little bit of audio trouble here and there with that one, so hopefully that sounds really good. Did you clean it up, Phil? You made it sound really nice.
Oh, yeah. Sounds like it's coming from a professional recording studio.
Boom. That's where Phil T. Engineer makes his money. He not only is a soon-to-be expert turkey hunter, but he gets the audio, makes it sound good. Listen, there's a lot going on for next week. We're going to continue this conversation about diversity in the outdoors and diversity in the hunting community. We're going to do it a lot, as much as we can. And again, as I said at the end there, we're going to try to grab a mentor and mentee from the Hunters of Color group and talk to them about their experience out there and get some of their personal stories, because I think that's also pretty damn important. But we're going to turn next week to something of a response. Now, do you remember a group called Anonymous for the Voiceless, Phil? Anonymous for the Voiceless.
Of course. Paul Bashir.
Couldn't forget that name. Now, we had him on to some acclaim. What was it? It was last year. It seems like every month is a year in the pandemic. But we had him on. It was too much conversation about what was going on with him. And one of the big topics there was around how many animals were killed by large-scale agriculture. Meaning, you go to the grocery store, you buy a head of lettuce, or in this case, I think we talked about rice as a strange kind of way to center the conversation. We had a guy named Jack Henry. That seems like a fake name, Jack, but we'll go with it. Jack Henry is a recent graduate of Cal Poly San Luis Obispo in biological sciences. He wrote me a whole email breaking down, you know, death in agriculture. He's done the studies. He really quantified it, even like metabolic needs, detection probability, all of predation from eagles, hawks, foxes, to try to suss out that point of that podcast with Paul Bashir. So luckily, this guy knows the facts that I didn't know at the time that we recorded with Paul. So we're going to go into kind of the history next week of the anti-hunting and the animal rights philosophies, where it began, how it came to be a thing historically, how long it's been around, how it's become what it is today, but then also look at Jack's numbers around vegans who might go shopping at the grocery store and feel like they are removed from the cycle of death in our world. So I think that's a very important follow-up from a long overdue conversation. So, you excited about that, Phil? You titillated? You ready to go for next week?
Oh, yes. My tittles are lated.
Nope. Of all the things you should cut out, you can't say your tittles are lated. That rhymes with something inappropriate. So you can't do that. All right, Phil, just say bye to the people and be excited for next week.
Goodbye, people. Too long, 'cause I can't go a week without doing wrong. Oh, without doing wrong.